I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in.
Hello, everyone. I'm Grace Porter. I'm here with the 7 Tools for the Change for Good Summit, Building Resilience in Anxious Times. And today I have the great pleasure of being here with my dad, Stephen M. Hall, MD. And today we're going to be talking about how functional medicine can help with anxiety, as well as building resilience. You see a common thread here. So I know a ton about my dad, but I thought that you might want to know a little bit more about him and his credentials before we get started with this conversation. So here's a little bit more about him. Stephen M. Hall, MD, began his medical career in 1985 as a residency-trained and board-certified family practitioner. His practice has been driven by his strong desire to help each person find and then treat the real causes or the real root causes of their health and life challenges while staying true to the process of science. His searching quickly took him beyond the borders of conventional medicine, and he has explored many of the world's leading healing traditions. He excels at taking seemingly disparate and conflicting ideas, finding common ground, and then integrating them. He developed and currently practices integral medicine, a form of medicine that seamlessly integrates the best of conventional medicine and many forms of alternative medicine. He has personally seen what works and what doesn't work for deep, authentic healing, and more importantly, has been delving into why. His passion is now to share what he has learned with the world. He is a public speaker and the author of 3 books, including The 7 Tools of Healing, Unlock Your Inner Wisdom, and Live the Life Your Soul Desires, as well as Fibromyalgia, an Integrative Personalized Approach, and Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, an Integrative Personalized Approach. He offers classes and many free resources to help you better care for yourself at the7tools.com. And he's in private practice in Issaquah, Washington. And you can find his website at stephenmhallmd.com. I remember that by thinking there's the most initials you possibly could have in there. So Stephen with an N, M, Hall, MD. Yeah. So I just shared a little bit more about you, but can you tell us even more about yourself and how you came to practice the way that you do?
I'm sure. Yeah. Thanks for that introduction. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, I remember wanting to become a doctor when I was 12 years old and sitting in 6th grade. And then later when I got into junior high, I found that I actually liked science. I was pretty good with science. And that continued on through high school and college. And so I applied to medical school. Then I sort of had a shock because in my undergraduate years, I felt like I was training myself how to think and problem solve. And then when I got into medical school, it seemed like all I was asked to do was memorize. I had to memorize anatomy and pharmacology and just all kinds of different things. And so that was a big shock. That took some adjusting. But I never let go of my roots in science. And what I really like about science is that data is primary. In other words, the actual results of your experiment are more important than the theories and that sort of thing. And so the data that we work with in medicine is all of your human experiences. And all of your human experiences have some kind of impact on your health. And so we need a system of medicine that can take all of your experiences into account, not just your bodily biochemical experiences. And I quickly saw that conventional medicine didn't really do that. And even as a first-year medical student, I started meeting people whose experience with their health didn't fit the medical model that we were being taught. Mm. And so instead of throwing their experience out, I thought, we need a different medical model, and one that's more expanded, one that can take into account what you believe and take into account nutrition. And just, there's all kinds of things. And so that's what got me searching, was this desire to develop a system of medicine that can treat you as a whole human being, not just as a body and chemical reactions. So it's taken a long time to figure all this stuff out, but I think I've come up with some pretty good answers to some of the questions.
They seem to work pretty well for your patients. So, yeah. So in, I mentioned in the intro the idea of functional medicine, but I'm not sure that that's a term that everybody's familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit more about what functional medicine is and how it's different from conventional medicine?
Yes. Yeah. So functional medicine is still, it's very similar to conventional medicine in that it's still focused mostly on your biochemical pathways and what's going on in your body, and doesn't look so much at things like your psychological health and your energy and those sorts of things. But the main difference in functional medicine is we're looking at you from like what they call a systems approach, whereas conventional medicine is what they call reductionistic. So like, for example, your body's divided up into 12 organ systems, and there's specialists for each organ system. Like your cardiologist looks at your heart, your neurologist looks at your brain, your gastroenterologist looks at your gut.
Or even in your 15-minute appointment with your primary care provider, you can bring in one concern and they're only going to talk to you about your knee.
That one concern, yeah. Right? Yeah, and that's thanks to your insurance companies. But the but how you function is as a whole system. All these things are integrated. They're all going on at the same time, and they have interactions, and they affect each other. So you can't just have your heart separate from your digestion, because your digestion provides energy to your heart. You can't have your heart separate from your brain. I mean, so in functional medicine, we're trying to see you from a bigger systems perspective, and that's the main difference. That has a lot of strengths to that.
Yeah.
Approach.
The other thing I've heard people talk about with functional medicine is more work on the preventative side, like that you're maybe working towards wellness, not just to alleviate illness. Is that how you think about it too?
Right. There is, I think, more of a emphasis on that when you can really get into it. Yeah. Because that whole idea about an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we do. And
yeah. So if we're talking about functional medicine as having a different lens, maybe looking at it from a more systemic approach or more of a wellness approach, can you talk about anxiety through the lens of functional medicine and how anxiety is conceptualized, what it is, where it comes from?
Yeah. So one of the overarching ideas is that a symptom is a clue that something somewhere in the system of who you are is out of balance. And if we can follow those clues back, it's like kind of like a treasure hunt. You know, if we can follow those clues back to the treasure and find the imbalance and get the imbalance corrected, then the symptom can go away. So rather than just treating the symptom directly, we want to follow its clues back to its root cause. And so anxiety, a feeling in general is a clue that, something's going on in your life, but it's also a clue to how you're interpreting that something. And so anxiety is essentially a feeling of threat, right? Impending danger. Maybe it's a response to real danger in your life. And so we talk about situational anxiety, where there's things going on in your life where clearly being anxious is an appropriate response. Like if you're living in a gang war zone, or there's a stalker after you, or there's your boss is trying to manage you out, stressing you out so much that you quit rather than having to fire you, there's a lot of different situations where it's clear that the anxiety is in response to the situation. But then there's also what we call floating anxiety. And that's where, if you look at the person's life, there's always the usual things going on that anybody could be anxious about, but they can't really put their finger on like what it is. And but it doesn't really matter, because that feeling is going to trigger the same response in your body, whether it's in response to an actual threat or an imagined threat or even something you're not even clear about. You're still going to get the same body response.
Or an anticipated threat.
Right.
If you're thinking ahead of what might be, it can feel like there are going to be threats down the line and you might be anxious about that.
Right. It's something like, remember something Mark Twain said, he says, I'm now an old man and I've experienced many a hardship, most of which never happened.
Pretty good. Yeah. I think there's kind of like that adage, you know, anxiety is like being in the future and depression is being in the past, and the goal is to be in the present.
Yeah. So you're between a rock and a hard place. You're always between depression and anxiety. No, I'm just kidding. So that feeling of anxiety triggers this physical response in the body. We call it your fight, flight, or freeze reflex, the stress response. And a lot of things happen in your body when that reflex gets triggered. One of the most important things we look at in functional medicine is you often develop malabsorption because your intestines shut down, and digestion is actually quite a high energy process where a lot of the nutrients have to be absorbed into your body against a concentration gradient, and that takes energy to do that. And so oftentimes you're not absorbing your trace minerals.
Can you say that again in English? Because what does that mean for to absorb against
So normally when, like, say you drop some salt into some water and you watch those salt crystals dissolve, if you could look at the water right close to the salt crystals, it'd be a really high concentration of salt in the water. If you moved a few inches up in the water and measured the salt level there, it wouldn't be very high. But over time, the salt will move through the water so that it's evenly distributed throughout the whole water. So things move from on their own, they'll move from a high concentration into the lower concentration areas. So that's just what things do on their own. But in the gut, you might have, say, some chromium in your gut, but it's at a lot lower concentration than it is in your cells. But your cells want to absorb that chromium. And so it takes energy to pump the chromium into the cells against that, where the natural flow would be for the chromium to flow from the cells back into the gut. So it would be like it would take energy to force that salt to leave the water and go back down into the crystal. It would take energy to do that. So that's kind of what I'm talking about with that.
Thanks.
And so you get that energy from, you know, it's just your own body's metabolic energy. And so when you go into that fight or flight response, the body takes most of the energy from the digestion and funnels it over to putting it into your muscles so that you can run or fight or whatever. And so then the digestion starts to suffer. Another thing that can happen in the gut with, if you trigger that fight or flight response too much, is you'll actually start developing reactivities to foods. Again, for the same reason that the barrier that separates your the contents of your intestines from your bloodstream starts to break down, and then things can get directly into your bloodstream that your body maybe doesn't want there, and then it'll start developing antibodies. And then you have food reactions. So that's a common symptom we see in functional medicine with people who are chronically stressed, is they often start getting reactive to all kinds of things. And we call that leaky gut. Doesn't mean you need diapers. It's leaking on the cellular level inside your body. And that leaky gut, because most of your body's immune system is in your intestines, If you keep that immune system on all the time and start making antibodies against the proteins that you're made out of, then you stand a high risk of developing autoimmune diseases. And so, you know, stress can actually be, or being anxious all the time can actually be at the root cause of several autoimmune diseases, or at least making them worse.
Yeah. Can you give some examples of what an autoimmune disease is? Because people may not know what that means.
Yeah, so a common autoimmune disease is like a thyroid disorder called Hashimoto's, where there's antibodies attacking your thyroid, and then your thyroid goes all over the place. Some days it's really high, some days it's really low. And over time, it tends to burn your thyroid out, so then you end up with low thyroid. Rheumatoid arthritis is another common autoimmune disease. Lupus, eczema is not necessarily considered autoimmune, but it's highly correlated with food reactions. And then several forms of arthritis, classic migraine headaches, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. And there's some data where they suspect it's antibodies against dairy proteins that are attacking the cells in the pancreas. So type 1 diabetes might actually be a milk allergy. So those are some common examples of where the body, they think about it as your body attacking itself. But I think of it as your body's attacking these foreign proteins, and the proteins in your body are sort of like collateral damage. That's how I think of an autoimmune disease.
Thank you. So what happens when your gut is inflamed that way? If you've got that inflammation in your gut, what does that mean for you, or what does that mean for people?
Well, that puts you in a, what I call a pro-inflammatory state, where it's easier for your body to get inflamed. So people tend to get overuse syndromes more easily, like tendonitis if they exercise too much. But there's an adage that if your gut's inflamed, then your brain's going to be inflamed. And I don't know that that's 100% accurate, because your brain has a blood-brain barrier to try to keep inflammation out. But it's very, very common that we see brain-associated symptoms when the gut's out of balance. And those symptoms are things like irritability, you know, people having a short fuse, basically, a hair trigger, mood swings, anxiety, depression. A lot of people have short-term memory loss, brain fog, headaches, and then sleep disruptions are also very common when there's gut inflammation going on. Anyway, so a healthy gut is very, very important. That's one of the things we look at very carefully in anxious patients, to see what's going on with their digestion.
Yeah.
We'll get into that a little bit more. So other things that happen when you're anxious all the time is, so the body takes energy away from your gut, but it also takes energy away from your immune system. And then bodily repair and regeneration symptoms. So you often get more frequent and severe infections. You're actually at a higher risk of cancer, because your immune system is constantly patrolling your body for abnormal cells. And if it's underfunded or short-staffed, you know, some cells can sneak past. And then osteoporosis, which is a really common problem in people, can be a result of long-term anxiety. So you get increased tightness in your muscles, like especially your neck and shoulders and back, which can lead to headaches, muscle contraction headaches. A lot of people we see with anxiety are clenching their teeth in their sleep, because you're anxious in your sleep as well. And another common symptom people have, they might not think of as an anxiety symptom, but that's restless leg syndrome. That's almost always caused by too much of the fight or flight system, you know, going in your system. A high blood pressure, hormone imbalances. Yeah, it can mess up your thyroid. It can mess up your adrenals, and it can mess up your reproductive hormones. So you get problems with your periods. Men can get problems with sexual function or impotence. It can affect your fertility. There's lots of studies about that. And then something you might have heard of is you get decreased heart rate variability when you're anxious too much. And your heart rate variability is basically how when you measure your heart rate, it's not uniform. It's not the exact same spacing between each beat. There's a little bit of variability. Like sometimes it might be 0.82 seconds, and sometimes it might be 1.2 seconds between each beat. But that variability changes, and when you're anxious and stressed, the variability actually goes down. And when you're calm and relaxed, the variability goes up. And there's lots of devices on the market now to measure your heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. And that could be one way you could track how your body's doing.
So it's a way to track how your body's doing more than it's, and I mean, like, it's, is it a problem for your heart rate to be, or is it just like a symptom of there being problems elsewhere?
It's just a symptom. It's not a, I don't think anybody's had a specific syndrome associated with heart rate variability, but it's a way of tracking to see, like, is today a day I really didn't sleep very well last night and I'm stressed out, so I better take it easier today? Or is it a day I can really go gung-ho because I've got lots of reserve and can really jump in with both feet? So
it's like a window into how you're doing.
Exactly. It's another way of monitoring your status. And a lot of athletes are getting into that, and high performance people are interested in heart rate variability, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
Our goal in functional medicine is really twofold. So the first goal is we want to figure out why you're having anxiety in the first place, but we also want to offer you relief of your symptoms in your day-to-day life until we do figure out how we can get your anxiety to go away. So that's what we're after with treatment of anxiety.
Yeah. So help with the symptoms in the short term and create an environment where the symptoms are not needed in the long term.
Right. Yeah, because again, there are clues something's out of balance, and we can find that balance. Sometimes it just takes a while.
Okay. So, and we've just talked about a lot of the symptoms of anxiety, how it might be showing up in the body. And those are things that, you know, conventional and functional medicine might be addressing. So I guess I would like to pop next into the root cause part and ask you, like, what it is that you see in your practice as being the root causes of people's anxiety as that becomes more clear for you.
Okay. Sometimes I see a person's anxiety as a clue that there's something wrong with their body, and they're not sensing it directly in their body, so they just get this sense of anxiety. And one of the most interesting cases of that was when I was first in practice in a small town in rural Maine. A woman came in who was having panic attacks. She'd not ever had them before, and she couldn't. There was nothing really major going on. Nothing had radically changed in her life. And just being out of residency, I did a pretty compulsive complete physical exam and found out that she had an infection in one of her fallopian tubes. It's often called pelvic inflammatory disease, or PID. And when we treated that, her panic attacks went away. But what was curious is she had no classic symptoms of infection of fallopian tubes. So sometimes you'll feel it hurt in your pelvis when you hit a bump in the car. Sometimes intercourse is painful. She wasn't having any of those symptoms. What was interesting is about a year and a half later, she came back with panic attacks again. And when I checked her, sure enough, she had another fallopian tube infection, but no other symptoms of it. So that's one side of the coin. The complete other side of the coin is I had a patient who was very intelligent, high-functioning woman. She was the CEO of her own company, and she was having a lot of chest pressure and chest pain and dizziness. And so, of course, she had the full evaluation by her cardiologist, which all came up negative. She had a full evaluation from the neurologist, which all came up negative. And this went on for several months. And we kept looking for, like, what could be going on? And then one night she went to the ER with her chest pressure symptoms. And I don't know how he thought of it, but the ER doc gave her a shot of anti-anxiety medicine. And all of her symptoms resolved right away. But she had no feeling of anxiety. She didn't feel stressed. She was like totally oblivious to that. But so then we started treating her symptoms as anxiety and she got a lot better. Mm. So I've seen it be both sides of the coin. But there are certain metabolic things that we look for in people with anxiety. We want to rule them out. So we make sure they get treated if they have them. And one common thing we see is an issue with their level of methylation. And that might not sound familiar to anybody, but it's called the MTHFR gene mutation. And if you look that up on Wikipedia, there's actually quite a good explanation of the MTHFR gene mutation. And what that is methyl groups are the simplest building block in organic chemistry. They're just a carbon with three hydrogens attached to the carbon, which leaves one more handle on the carbon to stick it on things. And so your body uses methylation for all kinds of things, from making your hemoglobin to detoxing in your liver to running your peripheral nerves. And it turns out that there's three neurotransmitters. These are chemicals that the brain cells use to talk to each other. Three of these neurotransmitters need to be methylated. And so it's the job of your folate and B12, which are two B vitamins, to carry the methyl groups and deliver them to the different metabolic pathways that need them. And the folate and B12 that you eat in your diet generally does not have a methyl group attached. So your body makes an enzyme whose job is to put a methyl group onto the folate and then onto the B12 so they can carry them and deliver them and get back in line, get another methyl group attached and that sort of thing. So if you have an enzyme, that means there's a gene in your DNA that codes for that enzyme. And it turns out that in humans, there's very common typos in that gene. And we don't need to get into all the details of, you know, DNA transcription and all that, but the bottom line is that one of the typos will knock the effectiveness of that enzyme down about 40%. And the other one seems to knock it down about 5%. And there's two common typos, and you have two copies of each gene, so that leads to six different possible levels of methylation that you might have going on in your body. And the people that have two copies of the worst typo definitely have clinical symptoms of not enough methylation. So they may have, like, the toxins that need to get methylated to get out of their body might build up in their system and they'll feel kind of sick and toxic from that. It turns out those neurotransmitters are serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And what's curious to me is your brain makes like 55 to 60 different neurotransmitters, but only those three are targeted by antidepressant medications. But they're the three that need methylation. It's like, is that a coincidence? And I read,
probably not.
I read recently that your gut uses 400 times more serotonin than your brain does. And so a lot of these people with methylation problems have digestive problems as well. The peristalsis doesn't work very well. So it's like the nervous system in the gut doesn't work very well. So the reason we watch out for this is there's a very simple treatment, which is to just take folate and B12 that's already methylated. And you can get these over the counter all over the place. They're very, very widely available now. And you just have to find the right dose that fits you, because unless you do genetic testing, you don't know which of those six levels you are. But anyway, so that's something we look for, because people with this methylation issue often have mood swings, often deal with depression and anxiety. Sometimes it shows up as ADD. But usually there's a family history of other people in the family also having depression, anxiety. Sometimes there's a history of suicides in the family. And those are all clues that to look for this particular issue. So did it feel like I explained that okay? Or I know it's a lot of information, but and there's plenty of resources to read about the MTHFR gene mutation.
Yeah, I think you explained it great. It's I think it's something that I'm aware of it because it's also something, I mean, well, we have it in our family, but but it's also something that has impacted fertility. So in our own fertility journey, it was something that people were talking about a lot because when they were treating their MTHFR issues, sometimes they were then able to get or maintain a pregnancy better. So it's something that's starting to get more noticed by more doctors. It's getting to be a little bit more mainstream. Like you're saying that the treatment for it is available at your local health food store or vitamin shop or wherever you don't have to get it through a doctor anymore. So it's, I think it is getting more widely recognized as a problem. I know a lot of therapists who ask their clients who have anxiety if they've been tested for this. It's getting to be it's an easy place to start for sure.
Yes, and the issue we've run into is a lot of insurance companies have stopped paying for the genetic testing for it. And so the best way now to get it would be to do something like 23andMe or some other genetic sequencing, and then just about any service you use, like Gene Genie or some other service that interprets the 23andMe data, will include the MTHFR genes in their analysis. So that's probably the best way to see if you have it or not. So another interesting contributor that many people may not have heard of, because it was actually uncovered by a rheumatologist here in Washington, down in Auburn. He's now retired, but he specialized in fibromyalgia. And there have been a few reported cases over the last several years of from the neurosurgeons, where people with fibromyalgia had a particular constriction in their spinal cord. And when that was surgically corrected, their fibromyalgia went away. And he knew from animal studies that if you just physically touch the cervical spinal cord, where it's the part of your spinal cord where it runs through your neck, that triggers the fight or flight response in your nervous system. And so he wondered if that was happening to his patients. And he convinced the radiologists at the local hospital to, when he ordered an MRI of the neck, to include a view where their neck was fully flexed, like they had their chin all the way on their chest, and another view where their neck was fully back, like you were looking at the stars. And sure enough, he saw in these flexion and extension views that in some people the cervical cord was getting touched by bulging discs or bulging ligaments. And he found a physical therapist that worked really well. And then if the constriction was bad enough, he found a neurosurgeon that would work on these people. And a lot of times they'd get their life back. And once they got their neck stabilized, their fibromyalgia and their anxiety and all kinds of problems would resolve. And so what he found, he called it the positive hairdresser chair sign. And you know how when you go to the hairdresser, and they put your head back in the sink to wash your hair.
Yeah.
So if that makes your symptoms worse, he's found there's like an 86% chance that you had what he called positional cervical cord compression. And I went down and spent a day with him before I retired, and he taught me all this stuff. And I found that to be pretty true. If people say, "Well, I just can't do that. I can't let them put my head back in that sink." Or if I say, well, if you're out looking at the stars, does that make your symptoms worse for a day or two? If they say yes, and we do the MRI, they almost always have their cervical cord getting touched. So again, if that's happening to you, you could do therapy till the cows come home, and it's probably not going to help your anxiety, because every time you turn your head or look around, you're triggering your fight or flight response. That's something that you need to keep in mind too, because once that's treated, then the other treatments do start to work better.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there other things like this? Like what else might be the sneaky causes of anxiety?
Chemical sensitivities. Again, if you're anxious or stressed long enough and your nervous system gets, or your immune system gets this hypervigilance where it feels like there's a threat all the time, you might start reacting to perfumes, to diesel fumes, to new carpets. A good clue is if you can't go down the detergent aisle in the grocery store without getting a headache or getting sick. That's a clue you might have chemical sensitivities. That could be affecting your brain and causing more anxiety. And again, similar issue with heavy metal toxicity. I just had a patient that lived in the Midwest, and she ate a lot of fish out of the lake, and she literally got mercury toxic to the point where they thought she had MS for a while till she figured out what it was, and they detoxed. She went through detox. Within 2 years, she was a lot better. So some of these heavy metals are getting significantly high enough in the environment that they can affect us. And
yeah,
we might not know it unless we go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking about what you were saying about where the allocation within the greater system, like allocation of resources. And I'm wondering about the process of detoxification, because we do have systems in our body that are designed to help us detox when we, detox the, things in our livers and all of that are, they're there to help us detox. But I'm wondering, is that something that gets impacted when we're feeling stressed out, or what is it, an overload? What's happening?
That's a really good thought, 'cause that's not something we often include in the list, but you're right. Detoxing would be one of those ancillary services that the body would not think was absolutely necessary while you were evading the tiger. And so it would take resources away from your normal detoxing, which you're exactly right. I think bodies are very, very good at detoxing because they're constantly making their own metabolic waste that has to get rid of. And so usually you don't get trouble with toxicity until those normal systems are overwhelmed. And so leaky gut can overwhelm it because you get so many more toxins in, high load of environmental toxins. But you're right. If you're stressed, you don't have enough energy to detox appropriately. So lower levels are going to be more significant to you. Lower levels of toxins.
Yeah. Would mold be the same?
Exactly. So mold is another one that's starting to catch a lot of attention. Mold makes a lot of different chemicals called the mycotoxins. And we now can test for mycotoxins in your urine. Sometimes if people live in a moldy environment, and like up here in the Northwest, over 50% of the buildings up here have water damage and may have mold in the walls or in the floors.
Or just mold on the windowsills from the moisture all winter long.
Condensing on the windowsills, yeah. But that mold can actually start to grow in your body and keep giving off mycotoxins right in your own body. Hmm. So mold testing is something that, again, functional medicine doctors think a lot about, but conventional docs may not consider that too much. So those are all things that I think are important to evaluate, make sure you're not dealing with them, because if you are, it's good to, those things can be treated. It's good to rule out any of those metabolic causes, and then you can focus on, belief imbalances and things like that.
Yeah. And those are all things I remember from when I had my own functional medicine battery of testing done a few years ago. Those are all things that there are tests for that you can see. I remember my styrofoam level was really high, and they were like, do you eat out of takeout boxes a lot? And I was like, no. And then it was well, maybe you're not detoxing, right? It's the testing is there for these things. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There's good testing for heavy metals. There's good testing for mycotoxins. And if you can convince the radiologist to do a flexion extension view when they do an MRI of your neck, you can detect the cervical cord compression. There's genetic testing. There's hormone testing. There's antibody testing.
And the functional medicine hormone testing is different than the hormone testing. It's broader.
Usually a little more thorough, right?
Yeah.
We might look at more things. One test a lot of people are using now is the urine organic acid test. They call it the O test, organic acid test. A lot of the different metabolic pathways give off waste products that can be detected in the urine. And so those are clues to whether or not the pathways are working well or not. Hmm. So they can assess your mitochondria. They can assess your oxidative status. They can assess all kinds of things with this O test. So yeah, the nice thing is we don't really have to be wandering around in the dark so much anymore like we did 30 years ago. We can do a lot of testing to know what's going on. Trouble is, of course, a lot of this testing is not covered by insurance. So some is and some isn't. So the other cause of anxiety I see a lot, some of the biggest imbalances I run into in my practice, I call it belief imbalances. And they're, I think, probably more significant than metabolic imbalances for most of my patients. And these are things like, you know, self-judgment, self-criticism, how you have that little voice going in your head that's always putting you down, low self-esteem, a sense of that you don't deserve to be treated with honor and respect. Some people have kind of arrested emotional development. They're kind of stuck in high school or stuck in elementary school emotionally. And then people are talking a lot now about executive function and poorly developed executive functioning. And your executive function, you think of it basically as the part of you that organizes and prioritizes your life. And there's break it down into like six categories of executive function. And so if there's problems with those, that can lead to a lot of anxiety because you just can't, you know, if you can't prioritize, or if you can't stay focused, or you can't make decisions, that can lead to a lot of anxiety. So, yeah. And then of course, just stressors of all shapes and sizes, all kinds of stressors can lead to anxiety. So I've seen the wide gamut. There's physiological stressors like reacting to gluten but not knowing it. That's a stressor on your body. There's the psychological ones, the social stressors, environmental stressors. We haven't talked about EMFs. We haven't talked about, you know, world politics. I mean, there's a long, long list of stressors that we have to deal with that can lead to anxiety.
Mm, yeah. So once somebody is in your office and you've identified that anxiety is an issue for them, what do you do to treat it?
Well, of course, we want to start that process of finding the root, and then we want to do whatever else we need to help make them more comfortable and functioning right now. So obviously a good history is the first place I start, because I've found that if you take a good history, that you're going to get the answers you need 90% of the time. And so, you know, we ask about, you know, what was your childhood like? Because most of those beliefs that shape your worldview, and then your worldview determines how you interpret your experiences to be whether or not they're stressful. Most of those beliefs were in place by the time you're 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And most of those first 7 years, you don't remember. And so you might not even know those beliefs are in there. And so you can get a kind of get a clue what a person's dealing with by how what their family was like when they were growing up. And then of course the timeline is important. What was going on in your life when these particular symptoms started, and what was going on when they changed. And so we can get a lot of clues that way. I like to do a good physical exam, especially one that's, guided by their history, and look to see what could be going on. And then we talked about there's so many tests available now that we can't do all the tests on everybody. That would cost tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And so that's the idea behind a personalized approach, where we sort of custom fit the tests to what are most likely to give good result, or, you know, give us some important information. So there's a lot of routine testing that most doctors do, like looking at your red and white blood cells, looking at your liver function, your electrolytes, kidney function, that kind of stuff. A lot of doctors will look at your thyroid and iron and those kinds of things. But then there's all this specialized testing that tends to be more common in functional medicine. Like, you can actually test to see how your adrenal glands are doing, where they fall on the whole spectrum of adrenal fatigue, from normal adrenals to completely pooped out adrenals. And adrenals tend to get pretty ignored in conventional medicine. We can test for most of the known causes of leaky gut. There's about 20 some odd causes of leaky gut that we talked about, that urinary organic acid testing. I mean, test for heavy metals, mycotoxins. You can get little trackers to watch your heart rate variability. I mean, there's a lot of different things out there now. So, and then if we find anything physical or physiological, then we can treat it. So again, it really emphasized gut health. And this, it would be true for anybody, even if they don't have anxiety. So, but making sure your intestines are really, really healthy, because the effect of the gut on the brain and moods and behavior, we're really just starting to appreciate that. And I think naturopaths have known about it for a long, long time, but MDs are really playing catch up now. And the neurologists are saying they have to rewrite all their textbooks because none of them take the effect of the gut on the brain into account. Mm. And we just can't ignore that anymore. It's so important.
Yeah, I'm starting to see a lot more like CE classes being offered for therapists that are talking about the gut and mood connection.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's great. It's really good that people are catching on, because most of the gut issues are lifestyle issues, meaning you can get your gut to work better by changing your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So we want to find and eliminate any hidden infections in the gut. Like, you've probably heard of H. pylori. That's that bacterium that lives in the upper intestines that has been associated with ulcers and gastritis. But close to 40% of the population has H. pylori. Even though they might not have ulcers and stuff. But the H. pylori is still causing long-term activation of your immune system, which can then lead to the pro-inflammatory and all those symptoms we talked about with autoimmune diseases and sensitivities and things. So candida is another infection in the gut that gets totally missed by conventional medicine, and that's basically having a yeast infection in your colon. So, I mean, conventional docs know you can have a yeast infection between your toes, you can have a yeast infection in your groin, you know, in your vagina, in your throat. Why they think the gut is a special environment that's immune to yeast infections, I'll never understand. but that's a very common thing that we see, and that's very treatable to get the yeast back into balance. Protozoans are a lot more common in the U.S. than most people think. So these things like Giardia and Montezuma's Revenge, and you know, when you get those things, they can stay in there a long, long time. And then there's, of course, unfriendly bacteria. Every bacteria on the planet would love to live in your intestines if they could. It's a great environment for them, you know. Mm-hmm. But your body doesn't want all those bacteria there. So, right. So those are all things that are really important. So then you want to find and eliminate any reactive foods, because food reactions are usually caused by leaky gut, but the food reaction, once it forms, it becomes a cause of leaky gut, and then you're caught in this vicious cycle. So just statistically, the most common reactive foods we see are grains, especially gluten-containing grains, dairy, eggs, and soy. Those are probably the big four. For gut health, you want to minimize processed and refined foods, and just maximize whole foods, like, you know, real food, like greens and salads and vegetables and fruits and meat and fish and chicken, nuts and seeds, you know, and stay away from all the stuff that's got a man-made wrapper around it. And then fermented foods are really helpful, really important for most people, unless you've gotten so far down the road that you've got histamine problems, which we haven't talked about. But so most people can tolerate sauerkraut, kimchi, kombucha. Mm-hmm. You can make fermented pickles. You can a lot of times make your own fermented foods. There's books on it. Sandor Katz has written a couple of excellent foundational books on how to do your own fermenting at home. But that's one of the best ways to keep your friendly bacteria in check, because the store-bought probiotics, you don't know their history. And if they haven't been kept refrigerated, they're probably not viable. Plus, you can buy a heck of a lot of sauerkraut for the cost of some of those probiotics.
It's true. They're pricey.
Yeah. And obviously, minimizing sugar is important for your health. And then turns out bone broths are one of the best sources for the bioavailable minerals. And bioavailable means it's easy for your body to absorb them. And they come in the right balance for your own bones and that sort of thing. And then since stress has such a huge impact on the gut, you know, learning how to make yourself immune to the stressors in your life, that's really probably one of the most important things you can do for gut health. And I personally think that learning and practicing the seven tools of healing are one of the best ways to make yourself resistant to all the different stressors in your life.
Yeah.
So we've talked about adrenal fatigue. There's treatment for that if you have it. There's support. So mitochondrial fatigue, that's another issue. Mitochondria get ignored in conventional medicine. And your mitochondria are the powerhouses for your cells. That's where your proteins, carbs, and fats get turned into energy that the cell can use. And pretty much the same life experiences that will give you adrenal fatigue will also give you mitochondrial fatigue. And so that's something that should be looked at. So if you're being treated for adrenal fatigue, you might want to look into getting treated for mitochondrial fatigue as well. So systemic inflammation is another thing that we really like to treat and watch out for in people with anxiety, just because of the effects it has on your whole body. And again, gut problems or chronic sinus or some other kind of chronic infection somewhere, that's one of the most common causes of systemic inflammation. We look for those. And then hormone imbalances, again, and not just thyroid, but there's your cortisol and DHEA can be out of balance if you have adrenal issues. If you have liver overload symptoms, like your liver's too swamped from problems because of leaky gut, then you can't balance your other, like your ovarian hormones, and you can get PMS, you can get messed up periods. A lot of times getting your digestion straightened out really helps with those kinds of symptoms. So, and then if there's any emotional or psychological or social stressors, they usually do two things. One, we look at the situation you're in, and if there's anything you can do within your power to improve that situation, then by all means do it. But so many of the situations when are sort of outside of our power, and so then we have to do just to whatever you can do to really increase your resilience and to be able to tolerate that. You can do it through therapy, through coaching. Craniosacral therapy is a great way to learn how to listen to your own inner wisdom and follow its advice. And then, of course, so is practicing the seven tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if all of these things are things that are working and helping with the root causes and treating the symptoms medically, what are some of the things that you have found to be particularly helpful for people in managing the acute symptoms in the moment while all of these other, I mean, imagining supporting your adrenals takes a little bit of time. It's not a, you know, they walk out of the office, all of a sudden their adrenals are functioning better. What do you recommend for people in the meantime?
Right. So some of these tests take 2 or 3 weeks to even get done. So, and then the treatments can take weeks to months to really start to work. So you're exactly right. So I think one of the most powerful skills for people to learn for short-term management of their stress is that your mind actually follows your breath. And so if you consciously choose to tune into your breath and slow your breathing down, that often calms your mind. And so we want to slow your breathing down both in how often you breathe, but then how much you breathe during each breath too. So one of the things I say is breathe through your nose and try to slow your breathing down to the point where you can't even hear the air going in and out of your nose. Try to breathe that slowly and calmly. And then let your chest completely relax in between each breath before you breathe again. Let it go to complete relaxation. And a lot of times just a minute or two of breathing like that will get you down off the ceiling. So that's one of the simplest things people can do. Another important thing is to trade your coffee for green tea, because especially up here in the Northwest, where Starbucks started and everything, you'll still get a little bit of coffee with the green tea, but green tea has L-theanine in it, and that's an amino acid that promotes calm. So you can also take L-theanine at 200 milligrams twice a day if you need to, so that's a calming amino acid that makes calming neurotransmitters. Can also take taurine. So taurine is another amino acid, but this one's a precursor to GABA, which is gamma aminobutyric acid, and that's probably the brain's most important calming neurotransmitter. And 500 milligrams a day for the taurine, but you can also, turns out now, you can get GABA by itself, and you can take up to like 200 milligrams a day if you're having a lot of anxiety throughout the day. There's a lot of calming herbs and nutraceuticals, passion flower, valerian, skullcap. We've got some herbalists on the program that will go into a lot more detail about those things. 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan, is another precursor for serotonin that's very calming and helps with sleep. Magnesium citrate or magnesium malate is a great way to take your magnesium. And it turns out most people are now restricted or deficient in magnesium because of the way our food is grown on the soils and things. But I know there's homeopathic remedies such as Calms Forte, and there's flower essences and essential oils that can help really reduce anxiety and increase your sense of calm too.
Yeah.
And then of course there's your favorite mindfulness meditation is always helpful. And then I would really suggest you check out these yoga nidra meditations to help with anxiety. And I think, Grace, you're an expert in yoga nidra. You could tell people more about that.
Yeah, and yoga nidra actually does a lot of boosting of the neurotransmitter support. It's also like when you're doing yoga nidra, you have increased GABA, you've got, so all of these things that you're talking about supplementing yoga nidra can help augment in your body.
Do naturally, right?
Yeah.
Where you don't even have to, because a lot of these things are natural things. You don't have to take them. You can get your body to make better levels of them.
Yeah.
Through yoga nidra and things.
Yeah.
And I think we have some yoga nidra meditations on the Seven Tools website.
We do, yeah. And there's a talk, Kamini Desai is talking about yoga nidra in this summit. So you can check out her talk for more information about yoga. She's the woman that I trained with. So, yeah.
Oh, great.
So if people are wanting to pursue a functional medicine evaluation, how do they get connected to a functional medicine practitioner? What resources are available to them?
Well, so luckily, more and more doctors are getting interested in functional medicine and getting trained in functional medicine. And so there's an organization called the Institute for Functional Medicine, or IFM, and they maintain a website that has a practitioner locator on it. So you can actually find somebody that's been through their courses. Now, just because they've taken those courses doesn't mean they're necessarily doing functional medicine in their practice, but there's a pretty high probability of it.
Mm-hmm. Or that you could ask them to look at you in that way.
Yeah, another good way to find a good functional medicine doctor I've found is to call some of these labs that specialize in functional medicine testing, like Diagnostics and Genova and Great Plains. Those are some common labs. SpectraCell is another lab that's used by a lot of functional medicine doctors. And the labs will probably be willing to give you the names of practitioners in your area that utilize their services. And I think they're motivated to do that because they know if you go to these doctors, they'll order their tests, you know. So it's like, but
symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. But if they're ordering those tests, then you know they're actually doing functional medicine in their practice. They didn't just take a bunch of classes and then aren't doing it.
Right.
So that's a good way to find a good functional medicine doctor in your area. But also remember, a lot of naturopaths and chiropractors are actually quite proficient at functional medicine too. So it doesn't have to be an MD.
And there are nurse practitioners who have gone through the training also.
Yeah, and a lot of them probably, they might not have gone through the IFM directly. Like, I'm not even listed on their website because I've been doing this longer than there's been an IFM, and so I never really felt the need to take all their classes. But you can find doctors in your local area or practitioners, not necessarily MDs, that do these kinds of evaluations. If you call the labs or look around, you can Google it on, you know, functional medicine on for your area and just see what comes up. But I think that Seven Tools of Healing book, I tried to put everything I've learned in the last 30 some odd years of doing this kind of practice. I tried to put most of that in the book. And then there's a lot of good resources on the website. There's online classes to learn how to build resilience and make yourself impervious to stress. So I would definitely check out the Seven Tools website for resources as well.
Yeah, we're definitely doing complementary work to the medical piece of it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're getting to the end of our time today, so I'm going to ask you our famous question of that: if you could leave three listeners, everybody else is on their own.
There's more than three listeners.
But if you could leave three listeners with all of the tidbits, now if you could leave our listeners with three tidbits of advice that could help them with anxiety, like practical tips, what would those three things be?
Well, the first thing I think is to pay attention. You know, be really mindful and listen to the clues that are coming to you through your body and through your feelings, and actually, you know, through your whole life. I mean, everything in your life is constantly talking to you. And then learn how to interpret those clues accurately. So that's another important step. And then work with a good practitioner if you need to in order to do that. And then the third tidbit I would say is, actually take the steps towards health that your life is asking of you. So you actually have to do what your body is asking if you want it to respond in a healthy way.
Imagine that. But it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that takes practice.
Yeah.
It takes practice. So listen, interpret it correctly, and take the steps.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for sharing your medical expertise with us on this today. I think that it's the tip to get a good physical evaluation with somebody who's able to look at you in this way is really important if anxiety is something that's causing problems in your life, because it is, there is a, you know, where is it coming from? Is it coming from a physical thing, or is it coming from an emotional thing? And if you want to be able to have the information so that you can take the right steps towards wellness, and so remembering that this is an important part of that puzzle is pretty good awareness.
Yeah. So remember that holism means all of you, mm-hmm. and all of your life. And so anxiety gets lumped into the mental health realm quite a bit, and for good reason, but make sure you look at all of you, your physical and environmental and all those different things as well.
Well, yeah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to share all this information.
Yeah. Take care.